Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And we want to thank you for listening to our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this particular episode cannot replace your consulting your primary care physician and other specialists that are recommended by them. Because over the last few months, we've addressed substances and alcohol use disorders. And today, we will look at another epidemic, which we really think you will enjoy listening to, called food addiction.
Now, I'm hoping that our audience are not sitting by a cup of ice cream and cookies and all
it's
kinds
like,
of
uh-oh.
Things.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
But let's look at some of the signs of food addiction.
So there are quite a few. There's an obsession with food or weight. And so it goes both ways. So a lot of times people think that food addiction is always associated with obesity, but not necessarily so. There's overeating, binging or grazing repeatedly, undereating too, or restricting food, being underweight or overweight, vomiting, purging, compulsive exercise or dieting, and all the medical problems that result from overeating or undereating. And a lot of times it's associated with despondency, shame, isolation, and hopelessness.
You know, even in our lexicon, we have terms like comfort food. And I don't know about you, but comfort food elicits things to me like macaroni and cheese and
yeah,
sweet potatoes.
Highly processed food.
Highly processed foods, exactly. You know, but can you review for us the issues that we are facing when we talk about food addiction?
So as expected, the large number of people with this issue are overweight. And according to the Census Bureau, 2/3 of Americans are overweight. And 1/3 is considered obese. And type 2 diabetes is one of the leading causes of death. And as we know, obesity is a major factor in diabetes because it creates a sense, a state of insulin resistance, which means that the insulin that our pancreas releases doesn't really work very well. It kind of like paralyzes it. And this is really an alarming statistic that by 2050, 1 in 3 Americans will have diabetes.
That is staggering when you think about it. I'm also reminded of a number of patients that I've seen in my office who talk about snacking throughout the day, and I review with them what happens when insulin is continually released, and they are not aware of what damage they're causing by the constant consumption
yeah.
of foods.
Hyperinsulinism,
yeah.
correct.
It's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
So what happens in the brain in food addiction?
Very interestingly, addictive substances such as opioids and other drugs are highly reinforcing, and some individuals consume them compulsively, as we discussed in our previous episodes. But highly processed foods are really the villains here. They have an unnaturally high concentration of refined carbohydrates and fat, and they are highly reinforcing, and they are very effective in activating the reward-related neural systems. And minimally processed foods don't do that. And the highly processed foods are associated with the behavioral indicators of addiction, which are diminished control over consumption, strong craving, continued use despite negative consequences, and repeated failed attempts to reduce or eliminate intake. So the key piece in food addiction are the highly processed foods. And like addictive drugs, highly processed foods are complex human-made substances designed to deliver reinforcing ingredients like refined carbohydrates and fat.
And I don't think people stop to just translate the ingredients when they're looking at their item that they're purchasing.
Right.
In my office, I tell folks all the time, you know, if you're hungry, you can only eat so many apples. You're not going to eat 3, 4, 5, 6 apples.
That's a very good point.
But you will eat a whole bag of chips or a whole thing, a carton of sugars.
Or a bunch of donuts.
Or a bunch of donuts, because it's so highly processed, very palatable, very easy to just get into the system and spike your sugar. But it doesn't taste quite the same, unfortunately. Yeah. What is the role then of withdrawal and tolerance in food addiction? Because these individuals definitely need to refuel periodically because of a sense of emptiness.
That's true. And while in addiction, one of the we have criteria, 11 and 12 are withdrawal and tolerance. Mm-hmm. But there is a good element of that in food addiction, but it is not necessary. It's not vital for these two processes to be there. But like we were discussing, people feel out of sorts when they, so there is definitely tolerance. And that, you know, we'll talk about the glycemic index, but basically what happens is that when you ingest highly processed foods, there is a trigger of insulin release. And when the insulin is released, it careens the blood sugar, and particularly if it's refined sugar. And what it does then is that from a very elevated sugar, it careens it to a low sugar. And then the person feels out of sorts. They feel dizzy, lightheaded, out of sorts. And then it also sets up, because the body is such a remarkable computer, it recognizes that the only treatment for that is more sugar.
More sugar.
More highly processed foods. Mm-hmm. And so that cycle keeps continuing. Yeah. So there's definitely a process of withdrawal, but it's not one of those things that a food addiction can be there without these two there.
And you can see that eating highly processed foods, it doesn't really fill you up because there's very little, there's no fiber. So the fiber fills you up.
Precisely.
And then you can stop, but not with the highly processed foods.
And in the delivery too. The fiber is going to prevent the delivery of the sugar or delay it.
Delay it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And most individuals have tried numerous diets, and over 90% are ineffective. I used to work with the St. Vincent Medical Center Eating Disorder Unit, and you name it, I've heard of it as far as a diet is concerned. But diets do not work because no one can stay on a diet indefinitely. It has to be a lifestyle change. With this trend of increasing obesity, by 2048, it's predicted that most, if not all, of our healthcare expenses will go towards treating weight-related health issues. That's staggering.
It is.
And it's preventable.
Yes. Yeah. But particularly when it's right in your hands. So we talked a little bit about the highly processed foods. And so people will say, so what are they? So pizza, ice cream, white bread, cookies, potato chips. Now, interestingly, compose the majority of the U.S. food supply. I mean, that also is staggering.
It's staggering.
How are highly processed foods created? They're created by combining refined carbohydrates and fat, often along with sodium and food additives, at concentrations that surpass naturally occurring foods.
Surpasses.
So this is not something you can do at home.
No.
As a general rule. This is something you are buying. And so my patients will say, well, if you're going to tell me that I can't eat white flour, white rice, potatoes, and sugar, then what am I eating? So I tell them that chicken, turkey, fish, and whole wheat bread. So minimally processed foods are those, fruits, vegetables, and legumes, like beans, peas, you know, those kinds of things. And National Survey confirmed that most adults and even young children consume excessive amounts of highly processed foods because of that that cycle that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And when their attempts to stop or reduce the highly processed foods fail, they just kind of keep going. It's like a chronic relapsing mm-hmm. condition, even though they realize that they're gaining a whole bunch of weight. But the process keeps going on.
I think people can identify with what you just said, because on a particular day you get home, you're tired and you need something good to feel good. So you go into your fridge, you find the most delectable thing. Oh, that didn't do it for you. So you have to now find the next delectable thing. That didn't do it for you. And so on and so on and
yes,
so on it
yes.
goes. Yeah.
And then you choose the one that really does it for you.
Yeah.
And people tell you staggering amounts of what they really eat. And because these foods are, like we're talking about, highly reinforcing and mood altering. Mm-hmm. So they will elevate your mood.
Mm-hmm.
even though, like the cocaine crash, you'll come back crashing later on when you are going through a process of craving and withdrawal. But they do change your mood. And that's why we've invented these little wonderful things like comfort foods.
Comfort foods.
You know, like retail therapy. Yeah. So these kinds of little phrases.
But, you know, but food is one of the most reinforcing things we have in our culture. You celebrate with food, you mourn with food, you grieve with food. Everything has to be food-centered.
Yeah. And actually is present in most cultures. Mm-hmm. That it's and it's really well said. You said it really well that whether it's happiness or sadness, the element of food is just always there. Because I think some people feel the spike in the nucleus accumbens because it engages foods, engaged, highly processed foods, engage the reward system, lead to dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. Mm-hmm. And there are people who definitely get that. It's like the runner's high.
Yes.
They get the high from food.
Yeah.
I feel extremely grateful that I don't get a high from food. Because it would be kind of disastrous if I did.
And that's the thing, you know, because there's nothing wrong with food. We need it for survival. But overconsumption, it has side effects. And we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Right. And these highly processed foods have unnaturally high doses of reinforcing ingredients. Mm-hmm. And these reinforcing ingredients really cause that dopamine rush. And they also have this pleasant oral somatosensory, we call it, sweet taste, mouthfeel, and effects, the high, post-ingestive effects, we call it, the high that you feel after you eat. And we are also individually influenced by the visual, the auditory. Mm-hmm. So
the crunch of a chip.
The crunch of a chip, and also then ads, the texture. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, I didn't understand this texture piece. And then my daughter told me, I said, why would people have this particular, I don't know whether it was an avocado or it was something else. And she said, oh, it's the texture, because she's a foodie. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Olfactory, like the smell, the aroma, the taste, and then the social sort of setup that really increases. And, you know, just like we say, misery loves company, addiction also loves company. You enjoy it more if you're going to eat with someone else.
Absolutely.
Or if you're going to drink with someone else.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there are psychological cues which stimulate the reward system.
You know, as you were talking earlier about the taste and the delectability, I was thinking in my mind, oh, that sounds like a nice slice of cheesecake when you have it freshly baked and then it settles, New York style, not the refrigerator one. My brain just went off into a cheesecake
mode. Yeah, and you're still dreaming, I can tell.
I'm still dreaming about it. Because it reinforces, and then you have the memory to go by, which draws you back into the behavior. In food addiction, there may be impulsive personality traits that might increase the behavior. There are OCD components with intrusive thoughts related to food, and I think I just exhibited that when I talked about the cheesecake. These may be related to other psychological or psychiatric problems, such as depression and low self-esteem. People in depression, sadly, there are those who, when depressed, they overeat. And then there are those, when depressed, they do not eat as much. But most people tend to overeat for that comfort.
Right.
There may also be a genetic predisposition because, unfortunately, some families, they come in larger sizes. And then they tend to feed their children the way they've been fed and so on and so on. So that reinforces it. Perhaps we should look, maybe focus a little bit on the dopamine release associated with the food addiction.
Yeah, indeed. And that really goes to the addictive capacity of highly refined foods. So highly refined carbohydrates increase the blood glucose, like we talked about. And fat activates the vagus nerve receptors in the bowel to end up triggering dopamine release. So foods with high concentrations of both refined carbohydrates and fat, like chocolate, ice cream, French fries, pizza, are most strongly associated with addictive behaviors.
I just have to interject. You know, in my mind's eye, as you were talking, I was picturing these mad scientists in a lab creating a concoction that was the most addicting and going, I'll get you, my pretty.
Yes,
okay, that's what I was picturing. I was picturing that, but go on.
So individuals will addictively consume foods that are high in carbohydrates but contain little or no fats, like sugar-sweetened cereals, gummies, gummy candies, white bread. And the reason why they are so addictive is the ability of these foods to, as I mentioned, spike the blood glucose. And that really is what causes their addictive potential. So the highly refined foods, highly refined carbohydrates, are more strongly implicated in addictive potential of foods than fat. But the combination, we'll talk about that, is very, very important too. So while individual carbs or refined carbs will cause food addiction, but when it's combined with fat and additives, it's just a lot worse.
A lot worse. In our segment on treatment, we're going to talk about some of the things to do, including prevention, because as you were talking about the sugars, I was picturing some parents who, in order to keep their children quiet and behave, they give them a candy. They're treating them from early on. This is a reward for good behavior, you know. But the first mechanism in food addiction was the dopaminergic reward system. Another one is the glycemic index, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I touched on it, but it's really important. If anyone wants to Google it, it's very easy to do if one is not familiar with the glycemic index. So basically what the glycemic index is, the ability of a particular food to spike the sugar. So refined sugar is the baseline in terms of the index substance, which will, you know, yank up the blood sugar. And then it goes on, and the more refined a substance is, so white bread is going to raise your, it has a higher glycemic index than whole wheat bread mm-hmm. or rye bread. Mm-hmm. So understanding the glycemic index of foods is a very, very important thing, because for two reasons. One of them is that it helps prevent this dependence, this addiction to food. Mm-hmm. And second, it helps the weight, because not only is insulin a problem in terms of creating a feeling of unsettledness, craving when the blood sugar drops, it also, insulin is highly lipogenic, which means that insulin, when it's very high in its level in the blood, when it's circulating, so if someone is eating a lot of highly refined foods, the insulin level, if it's measured, is very high. And what that insulin does is it deposits the extra calories into fat.
Fats.
So understanding the glycemic index, and I really urge our audience to get familiar with the glycemic index and to check it on their phones before they and get an idea as to what foods they should choose.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, the internet is replete with information that may or may not be accurate, that are faddish, that are, you know, there are some simple things that we're going to recommend at the end of the next segment that they can do without making it too cumbersome.
Exactly.
So we're saying high fat foods alone doesn't seem to perpetuate addiction, right?
Yes, so high-fat foods with little or no carbohydrates like bacon or steak have a lower addictive potential. So like you said, people don't have six apples. Mm-mm. People are unlikely to have six New York strips.
Exactly.
You know, or repetitively. I mean, they might be able to have them in one sitting if you're very unusual, but repetitively is really the key. Mm-hmm. In addiction, it's the repetition which is the key piece. So The villain here really is the highly refined carbohydrates, much more than fat. But the problem is that when they are these highly processed foods frequently are combined, they combine these two major players, the highly refined carbs and the fat. So on its own alone, that's why you have the keto diet and you have the high protein diets, mm-hmm. because people lose weight with those. Mm-hmm. And they also cut the addictive potential of the sugar.
The carbs. But unfortunately, they cannot be maintained. I saw a gentleman once years ago. He was of average height and weight. And so we talked about his behaviors, his habits. And he mentioned that he was on a keto diet. I said, is it working for you? He said, oh, yeah, it's fine. So fast forward maybe 4 or 5 months, we met again. He had gained 60 pounds.
See?
So I look at him and I said, what happened? So he met a girl and she loved to cook. And that was the end of his diet. That was the end of his diet, yeah.
Yeah, that's not a part of the keto diet.
Right. In line with what we've been saying, they have found with functional magnetic resonance imaging, you know, they take pictures of the brain, that it's correlated with pathological responses in the brain, this activation. We know that tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and foods have that. And the effects of that, it can increase the dopamine. But when you surge the dopamine, then eventually it down-regulates the system, which means you require more and more.
Yep.
Of everything, whether it's drugs, whether it's food, we require
Correct.
More and more to get the same effect. So we have to be aware and we have to make adjustments.
That really goes into the delivery mechanism of food. And, you know, we are talking about the rapidity with which drugs of abuse reach the brain, with intravenous being the fastest and smoking being the second highest. So in food, the removal of ingredients like fiber mm-hmm. increases the addictive potential by right. increasing the rapid ingestion
the absorption.
Of reinforcing ingredients. Mm-hmm. So that's really an important concept to understand.
So what's the role of protein and sodium and other additives then?
Yeah, very interestingly, protein is not strongly associated with a reward response. And low protein diets can reduce satiety and increase the ability of the highly processed food to trigger a reward-related neural response, like a dopamine release. Sodium is a common ingredient in highly processed foods that enhances the reward value of foods with refined carbohydrates and fat. So we'd just like to imagine fast food is bad enough, but it wouldn't be as bad with just the refined carbs and fat if it didn't have the incredible amount of sodium that it does have. Yeah. So that it's the combination. It's the package deal. Mm-hmm. The package deal is the bad deal.
Yeah. I just want our listening audience, to visualize this lab with this scientist wearing the white coat and the black gloves creating this product for them.
Exactly.
So why are commercially prepared, highly processed foods different from homemade high sugar foods?
They're different because they have very high concentrations of rewarding processed ingredients like sugar and butter, which are the addictive pieces. And then industrial versions of these foods contain flavor enhancers like mm-hmm. glutamate and texturizers like gelatin mm-hmm. that further amplify the rewarding sensory. We talked about all of the, you know, the taste and the smell and the other pieces. So the rewarding sensory properties of highly processed foods. So it's all really while it is a science, I think it's more an agenda to take advantage of the consumer.
Mm-hmm. And it works.
Yes.
And we go back for more. Especially that cheesecake, and I can even make it at home, so that's not a good thing. But not everyone who consumes these highly processed foods get addicted, though.
They don't, and it's just like addiction to substances. Everyone who has people who are given opioids after an operation, there are a good number of people that will, if it's given for a long period of time, they will get addicted, but everybody does not.
No.
So a great deal depends on the way your brain is structured and the way the brain functions. And there are individual differences associated with highly processed food addictions, which are similar to other addictions like trauma, mood disorders, and impulsivity.
Situational and environmental factors are also important, aren't they?
They are, because they cause problematic food addiction, like cue-rich environments, eating in response to a negative situation or a negative mood, So, you know, going back to comfort foods.
Comfort foods.
And binge using. Mm-hmm. And environmental factors are sadly, and we'll talk about it this more in the treatment episode, widespread public health consequences are associated with highly processed foods such as affordability, accessibility, and marketing.
So maybe we can spend for just the next few minutes that we have, maybe talk about the role of withdrawal and intolerance in food addiction.
So we mentioned it about the tolerance and withdrawal, but primarily there's striatal activation in the brain. So basically the activation in the brain is diminished after repeated exposure to a sugar sweetened beverage, which is, so the brain adapts. It's consistent with neural adaptations, and that basically causes the tolerance. And then the withdrawal is that, like we said, the person becomes irritable, mm-hmm. there's anhedonia mm-hmm. when they cut down on the highly processed food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We do also have some objective measures, though, that we can recommend.
Right. And this is the wonderful part about medicine. We have the Yale Food Addiction Score, and they found it's a widely used evaluation tool in different populations, most often in patients with obesity who are searching for bariatric surgery. There's a clear association between elevated YFAS scores and eating disorders, especially binge eating disorders. It was initially published in 2009, and it is the scale is adapted the 7 criteria for substance use disorders and applied it to food addiction. And it produced a continuous symptom scoring method. So that's just basically a way to measure. Mm-hmm. But there is an impact of psychologic and psychiatric issues too, right?
Yeah, definitely. But also with the YFAS, they've found that it is very much valid and reliable. So it is a legitimate measure of the addictive behavior. Food addiction is prevalent in obesity, as we expect. But not everyone who is a food addict is obese or even overweight. It's prevalent in depression, especially severe depression. Some people gain huge amount of weight when they're depressed, and they'll come in even more depressed when they come back having gained 20, 30 pounds, literally. It's also seen with those who have high impulsivity, such as ADHD, those with PTSD, again, for the comfort measures. Unfortunately, for the women out there, it's 2 times more common than in men. Everything is more common in women. It's so unfair. You'll have a couple. No, it is. It's very unfair. You'll have a couple go on a diet, right? The male will lose maybe 20, 30 pounds.
Yes.
And the woman loses maybe 5 or 10. It's so unfair. That estrogen factor, it's real. It's also common in those with eating disorders. 57% of the eating disordered population compared to about 15 to 20 without any eating disordered behaviors.
I really want to address this cute episode you talked about. Men do not emotionalize food as much as women do. And they don't emotionalize their appearance the way that we do.
But it's their fault that women have to look a certain way.
Yeah, it's in industry.
I'm just saying.
I agree.
Everybody can write me if they want to. You can email me. I'm not going to respond because I still think the way I think.
The funny thing is that a patient of mine lost 35 pounds mm-hmm. in 3 months.
Yeah.
So I get very excited when people lose weight because I have this low-carb diet that I give them. And I said, how did you lose all this weight? And he says, you told me to lose weight, and I did. And I was like, I told myself, that is no help. Because if it was that simple, we would not have an epidemic of obesity, you know? So, but women, as women, we struggle. And we get happy about, I lost 2 pounds, and I don't want to depress the patient by telling them
burst
that could
bubble.
Be the weight, the clothes they're wearing. That it was different the last time. So it's very different between men and women. They
very
just
different.
Don't emotionalize it. There's no doubt about that.
Very different.
Hope you enjoyed this episode, and as we go through the various addictive substances, our next episode is just a part of this one. is going to be on the treatment of food addiction, which we are sure you will enjoy, because now that we have sparked your appetite,
no pun intended,
we will be addressing that. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Majibin Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer is the very talented Chris Pfeiffer. Please share this podcast with friends and family, for it is only through education that our society can be helped and we can stem the destruction that substance use and food addiction and morbid obesity causes. Just go to wgte.org/treataddiction or wherever you stream your podcasts. And with all the challenges of life, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. We hope to see you soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.